Hi, everyone. You're listening to the final episode of my three-part series called Gatherings of the Tribe. I encourage you to listen to the previous shows as well. In the first, I chatted with game journalists. In the second, I spoke with game critics. And in this episode, I speak with three guests, all of whom make games for a living. Matthew Burns from Shade Grown Games, Nels Anderson from Hothead Games, and David Carlton from Playdom. All three also happen to be terrific writers, and I encourage you to check my show notes for links to all of their work. I want to thank all my guests for helping me put this series of shows together, and as always, thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy the show, and away we go. I am pleased to welcome three more guests to the podcast. Two longtime veteran Brainy Gamer podcast visitors and one newcomer. And I'm really happy about the newcomer. I want to start with him, and his name is Matthew Burns. Matthew is the founder of Shade Grown Games, a game studio currently working on a new game called Plank. If you'd like to know more about that game, the Indie Games blog, which is part of the Gamasutra family of sites, recently did a feature on Shade Grown's development process, which is really good. It's a terrific read. And I'll link to that in my show notes. Matthew's also a very fine writer. He's a regular columnist for a Game Developer magazine. He has a piece in the latest issue of Killscreen magazine. And of course, he writes for his own website. And that may be where you already know him from. And that's Magical Wasteland. So welcome to the show, Matthew. It is great to have you on.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I feel like I've known you for a long time in that kind of virtual internet way.
Following your
work. So,
though you were in the closet for a little while, I seem to recall too. So that was an event when we learned who was actually behind Magical Wasteland.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, we can talk about that at some point. Why I had to be anonymous for a while.
Yeah. We'll call that the uncloaking. My next guest, good friend David Carlton. He's a programmer at Playdom, one of the biggest developers of social games on Facebook and MySpace. He also hosts his own website called Malvasia Bianca, where he writes about video games and other things. David is one of the co-founders with me and Dan Bruno of the Vintage Game Club, and he's also involved in the Video Games and Human Values Initiative with Roger Travis, me, and many others. David also attended a Midwestern liberal arts college, so you know he's very well educated.
Well, I actually grew up in a Midwestern liberal arts college, so.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. That would be Oberlin.
Yes.
Yes. A sister school to Wabash College. So great to have you back, David. Hope you're well.
Indeed.
And my last but not least, but perhaps most tired guest is Nels Anderson, gameplay programmer at Hothead Games, who released the well-received Deathspank. I smile even when I think about the game, Nels.
Excellent.
It's just, and Hothead, of course, is about to release another one. So just which is kind of amazing. We'll talk about that a little bit. And Nels is also the author of the Above 49 blog, where he writes consistently thoughtful essays on games, game design, all these places I've mentioned, websites, initiatives, magazines, all this stuff will be in the show notes. So welcome, everybody. Glad to have you with me. Thanks for joining.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Yeah, Nels, why don't we start with you? Because you had a particularly vivid experience at PAX, and we're talking about conferences. This is Gatherings of the Tribe, these segments. So tell us about your experience at PAX and sort of what you did.
Sure. So I just got back a couple of days ago. Myself and a bunch of the other folks from Hothead were there showing off both the second part of Deathspank, Thongs of Virtue, and our new game, Swarm. We were doing demos like basically twice an hour, one for each game, just there on the floor, giving out all kinds of swag. We gave out 600 polychromatic thongs, which was pretty fantastic.
Wow.
None of us really knew about it until like we showed up at the show and kind of our biz dev guy had been organizing everything. He's like, surprise, underwear.
So is there a picture of you wearing one of these polychromatic thongs?
There's definitely one of me holding one up.
Not quite the same.
But. Not quite the same. But hey, you never know what the future may hold.
Wow. Now, Matthew, you saw him there. I'm wondering if you could give me your account of Nels at PAX. Cool.
Nels is a very enthusiastic pitch man. He was
definitely manic, really.
Manic. Well, yeah, there was some, you know, Carnival Barker kind of things, some kind of Atlantic Seaboard kind of, you know, step right up, folks. Very enthusiastic, actually. You want that kind of enthusiasm when you're talking about your own game. So I admired it. The energy that he put into it. I think the crowd really responds to that kind of energy. You know, when you as a developer are excited about your game.
Do you find, Nels, that it's just a huge tonal shift going to PAX from, say, GDC?
Oh yeah, totally. I've actually been going to PAX for a pretty long time too. Basically, ever since I moved up here to the Pacific Northwest, because it's just I'm in Vancouver and it's just down in Seattle, right? So it's kind of no reason not to go. But for the first, I've gone to five. So yeah, for the first four times I went, I was actually an enforcer, one of the volunteer people that help run the show. So I was sort of doing like crazy, crazy work behind the scenes the entire time. So I've never seen PAX from like just a pure attendee's standpoint, but at least from my perspective, like I like PAX a lot. It's obviously very, very different from GDC. It's a consumer show. It's about product, which is good and bad. But the vibe is just wonderful, right? It's just a bunch of people who love games. And, you know, some of the cynicism and the tiredness and stuff can creep into the conversations sometimes is just totally banished. It really is just a weekend where people who love games invade Seattle and all hang out and just play a ton of games. So the fact that I'm exuberant and manic when I'm talking about my games is probably a function of just being in that atmosphere where everyone's just super, super stoked to be there.
I'm interested because you've been to so many of them. In other conversations I've had about PAX and other segments I've done already, or just, you know, listening to people talk online,
sure,
tweeting, it seems like is it borderline too big? Is it getting sort of out of control, or is it sort of cool that it's big?
No, I don't feel that way, really. I mean, of course, it's going to get big. Like, I keep thinking it's not going to get much bigger because the sort of takes up the entire convention center, but they just end up getting a different building in Seattle. I don't really
anymore. Yeah. That's the largest convention center in the state, actually.
Yeah.
So they can't grow. Yeah, after this.
But I never get the feeling that it's like it's too big, because all the cool stuff that people like really, really like about it is still there. Obviously, you know, there's kind of an E3, massive booths and tons of shirts being given away. But I mean, that's just sort of like part and parcel of a consumer show. I don't really find it a negative, because like the really good stuff, the stuff that people care about, is still there. I don't think it's been diminished in any capacity.
What about your perspective, Matthew? It must be different when you're working on a game and you're trying to sort of let people know about it and keep it in people's minds, but it's not released yet. Are you at PAX with that sort of mission behind you, or are you doing other things?
I really went just to be there and just to meet the other people who would be there. I didn't really have much of like a promotional thing in mind. Like, I know some of the other indies that, you know, that I'm aware of and that I'm friends with went and promoted their own games, even though they weren't out yet. But I went really just to take in the scene. Like Nels said, it really has a way of obliterating your preconceptions about, you know, the negativity. Like sometimes when you are just in the blogging sphere about games, there's all this talk, you know, why don't games matter more, and why don't more people care about games and stuff like that. And then you go to PAX and you just see this visual image of like thousands of people who have gathered just because they like video games and games in general, and people dressing up in costume and people just sort of having fun, and just actually experiencing that in person is like wow, a lot of people really do care a lot about games, and games really mean a lot to a lot of people, you know, and it's not just this like thing that sometimes we get into when we blog about stuff, like it's this subculture and isn't going to get marginalized and stuff like that. PAX is a great sort of antidote to that feeling.
Yeah. I am so jealous about it. I got to say, this is the year that it really hit me. I think I've kind of blithely missed it. I definitely will. I'll be there next year for sure. It's just a question of whether I can make the Seattle one or whether it'll need to be the Boston one. The problem for me is PAX is the first week of classes here.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's impossible for me to just take off during the first week of classes. but, you know, it may not happen that way next year. When you guys talk about this, both of you sort of sound the same kind of bell that there's a kind of an ethos there that's been established, that this is a place. It is a positive sort of vibe that, would you say that it's framed by the Penny Arcade guys, and it's just sort of, they've built this thing that has a built-in kind of ethos that you sort of understand and subscribe to? Are they the ones that have sort of made it like that?
I would say, yeah, absolutely. They take care, you know, like in the conference program is sort of 8-bit looking sometimes, or sort of game inspired, and the rules are pretty casually written, you know, and they're written in an amusing way, like the comic. So I think the conference program materials and like the way they try to cast the conference in people's minds sort of leads them to a certain expectation or a certain way to experience the conference, and it is largely a positive vibe.
Yeah, I think PAX has definitely grown beyond just Mike and Jerry and the comic strip and all that. But they definitely laid the foundation, and because they still kind of hold the reins, they haven't let it change. Like, you know, it's possible the conference could have been sold out or whatever to certainly make it more profitable. And it seems that explicitly they have not done that, and they want to make it sure it's like, this will always be a thing about people who play games and games, and that's it.
Yeah.
And I find that like even they have a rule where it's like, you know, no booth babes are allowed at the show. There can be certainly, you know, women who promote the game who are like costumed or who work for the company or whatever, but E3 is just like, here are some ladies with stuff who know nothing about this product, but they are scantily clad. And PAX explicitly said, nope, yeah, not at our show.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Does it do you good as a person who's involved in game development to be at PAX? I mean, obviously, as a fan, you guys both write about games. You're pretty passionate about it. But beyond that, is there a reason for a developer, a designer to be at PAX beyond just, you know, to hang out?
Yeah, I think it's important for people to sort of know what the game playing audience is. I mean, I think you'll read like an article online about like some of the really bad things that people say on Xbox Live, or posts and comments on websites and stuff like that. In fact, Michael, I think you wrote an article very recently about that, about a review of, was it Metroid?
Yeah, Metroid Other.
A review, yeah, a G4 TV review of Metroid, not Prime, but at Metroid Other M. It's interesting because you can see some of that at PAX as well. You know, people have t-shirts for sale that are like, I'm better than you at Halo or Modern Warfare 2, and, you know, go frag yourself and stuff like that. And that attitude is kind of there. But like seeing it in person for me helps explain it better. You know, like if I read a comment on a website like the kinds that you were pointing out, I think I would be angry. And angrier than if I had sort of overheard someone at PAX say it, because when you overhear someone at PAX say it, you kind of see who they are. They're like this 14-year-old kid in a, you know, go frag yourself t-shirt who's like picking his nose in line for pizza or whatever. So when I frame those kinds of things that happen on the internet in the context of some of the scene of PAX, it helps me understand better the audience, you know. That sounds really negative and mean, and I didn't mean to say it like everyone PAX is terrible, but I think it's important. You know, it's very easy to just, at a game company, it's very easy to only socialize with other people who make games, and they're not necessarily the same people as the people who play games. I mean, there's a lot of crossover, but,
yeah. it strikes me that it's possible that some of the very people who are saying ugly things and behaving badly in a forum, and I'm reading them and thinking, oh, this is the worst person in the world, that person is in line at PAX having a pleasant conversation with somebody and behaving in a completely different way.
Yeah, very much so.
A lot of this is just context, that there's a kind of culture of how to be kind of a jerk online, and then, you know, you would never bring that with you to PAX.
Yeah. And there's a lot that, for me at least, gets explained too when you meet someone in person or when you see someone in person, just the way they dress and the way they act. And sometimes, like, if I read something that somebody wrote and I disagree strongly with it, hearing them say it in person is completely different. It's a completely different experience, you know, like you can get a lot more of where they're coming from.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've felt that way a lot recently. Working as a social game developer, it's not always the most popular place to be in the, you know, areas of the industry where I was sort of hang out blog-wise. And I find that I mentally react quite differently if you or Nels are talking, you know, in our blogs about these topics than if it's some random person, or even not random person, whom I've never met before. Because if one of you says something, when I disagree with it, I'll know that, you know, you're a nice person, you're a sensible person, you've got a lot of smart things to say, and that will make it a lot easier for me to try to find areas where I agree, or listen to, if I disagree with something, I won't flip a switch in my brain and just go all negative in the way that I will if it's somebody that I've never met. So I think the personal context has been really helpful for me recently in that regard.
So real quick, just because I was thinking about this, what I definitely get out of PAX as sort of someone who makes games now is it's both enlivening and it really keeps you humble. It's enlivening because, like, you meet people who are so excited about your games. They're like, you know, I play this with my kid, I loved it. Or, like, this kind of humor is stuff I never see. Like, I was busting a gut constantly. And that's really edifying. They're actually these three young ladies. They came by the booth several times over the course of the show. On the third day, using one of those aforementioned swag thongs, that actually improvised an awesome Death's Bank costume. And then, like, they sent us pictures later. Hopefully we'll put them up on the website. They were actually, like, computer science students from the University of Victoria, just on Vancouver Island. So meeting people like that who are just really excited about your game is awesome. And then you meet all these other people who have never heard of your game ever, right? And it's like, especially when you're in the digitally distributed space, you know, you're not a BioShock, right? You're not a Halo. And it just kind of reminds you that, you know, what you do is really good, but you're still a small fish. And it keeps you humble. And actually, I sort of like that. It's refreshing. When you talk to people who they don't even know Xbox Live Arcade exists, right? You have to be like, well, no, it's not a game in a store. You go to the marketplace on your console, and then, yeah, it's just, yeah, gives you some good perspective.
Yeah, I liken it too. And I think this is really important. You know, I don't know if you ever, when you were a kid, if you ever saw, like, children's theater, if you ever went to see Peter Pan or something like that put on by a children's theater company. But inevitably, at the end of those productions, the actors come out into the lobby. And you get to, when you leave to go get back on the school bus, you go through the lobby and there are the actors, you know, and they're still in costume, and they're just kind of overwhelming to you. And there's this really wonderful thing where you get to sort of, like, thank them for that hour and a half show that they gave you, you know, that was really just kind of blew your mind. And it always has seemed to me that environment is kind of what happens, you know, in a kind of grown up way, that, you know, it's really cool to be able to walk up to somebody that gave you 60 hours of just amazingly awesome experience and say, thanks a lot, because that just, I can't tell you how fantastic that game is. To be able to say that to a person who had even anything at all to do with it. I mean, I think that's part of the compelling reason for going to these events, among many others.
Yeah, for sure. Totally. Yeah.
So, David, I'm curious about Playdom. Do you guys have a presence at PAX?
Not at all, as far as I'm aware. I didn't hear of anybody going to that. So certainly we've got people who speak at various, you know, various of the GDC conferences. but Playdom's audience is not the PAX audience.
Yeah, see, this is what I'm curious about.
It's very different.
I presume that you came across Warren Spector's keynote. You heard about it, his remarks.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, and I'm not asking you to speak on behalf of Playdom or anything. I'm speaking to you, but it seemed to me that he kind of hit the mark in some interesting ways there that you in particular might have found.
All right, you'll have to remind me a little bit of the details because
the gist of it was, and I don't know, Nels and Matthew can help me if I get this wrong, but the gist of it was that we need to be careful about dismissing the casual gamers or suggesting that somehow, you know, we're separate cultures and that we're somehow superior or they're inferior or whatever, but that we really need these guys. That we want to grow the industry. We need multiple cultures all happening around the same time, and that his basic thing was, we've won. Like, all this complaining about why are we marginalized, it's over, we've won.
Yeah, right. So that's certainly something that I feel pretty strongly about, is that no matter what, having tens or hundreds of millions of people playing video games who weren't playing video games before has to be a good thing somehow. This is an industry and an art form that we all love, and having more people share in that has to be a good thing. What I don't want to do from that is turn it into a popularity contest where, you know, games are better because they have, you know, Game X has more players than Game Y, so Game X must be better. But in fact, I'd be just as happy if we had a big expansion of the gaming audience and then that turned into 100 different micro genres of everybody playing video games, and there are a lot of different types of video games out there. But I think we should celebrate the fact that that there are more people playing video games than ever. And it's wonderful also seeing things like what you know, Roger and his colleagues are doing, getting video games percolating into the way that they teach, what you're doing, getting the video games percolating into the course curricula. It's exciting.
Yeah, and that portal as required reading thing is awesome, by the way, Michael.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I just walked back into my office here tonight from a meeting where we unveiled the syllabus to the students for the first time. We had posted it, but we just sort of said, if anybody wants to come talk about it, you know, we're here to answer questions. So yeah, it's exciting times here.
Do you have to actually figure out all of the puzzles in Portal?
Well, the story was picked up in, I've really learned a lot through this whole process. I have to say, you know, how a story can get told and retold and retold, and you know, by the fourth telling, it doesn't bear much resemblance to the first version. so you know, if you read the post that I wrote, it. You know, we're not all teaching it the first year. We're going to really test drive it, and we're going to see how it goes. It is on the syllabus. Students are going to be required to read it, but there are multiple sections of it. And you know, I have a lot of work to do to get my colleagues ready for that. And you know, you just can't press a button and say we're playing Portal. It's harder to roll out than you know, assigning a book to buy at the bookstore. But as a result of that kind of distortion, I've had to kind of answer to some of my colleagues or colleagues around beyond Wabash just about kind of what we're doing and kind of re-explain it, because some of the reporting wasn't exactly accurate.
I'm shocked to hear that.
Sounds like another good podcast topic.
Yeah, well, I suppose.
And that in a nutshell is sort of why people are cagey about talking about games, right? Like to the press or whatever.
Yeah,
that is usually what happens.
Yeah, I think I have a much better understanding of that now. I really, yeah, I don't think I even was close to understanding that. A little better now, maybe. I just want to, one more thing about this topic we were talking about. I wonder if at some point this huge casual gaming market, whether there will be a PAX for them. That PAX seems so dominated by hardcore gamers, whatever that means, serious gamers, whatever, people who are really into that particular kind of culture. That, you know, if there's how many million, 40 million, 50 million people playing your games, David, I mean, somebody's at some point going to say, hey, let's get together and have a Zynga Fest or a Farming Online Fest.
That sounds like a great idea. I think, of course, PAX came out of decades of culture formation of its own. And core video games, I think, demand a little bit more intense involvement in them, whereas there are many people who are intensely involved in casual games, but they're also designed to be just easy to drop into for a few minutes. So there are compensating factors as well. But. Yeah.
Well, let's transition to talk a little bit about GDC, because I know all of us have been there, and I'm curious to know why you go to GDC. I mean, I'm sure there's not just one reason, but Matthew, what's in it for you going to GDC?
There is so much that goes into making games. There's so many different disciplines. There's so many different ways to do it. There's so many different kinds of people that are making games. It's extremely important and valuable to go to GDC because you will very, very quickly find yourself in a rut of just doing the thing that you figured out that works as a developer. You know, we've always done it this way, or we know that this works. And learning about how other people are solving the same kinds of problems that you are is it's incredibly important, you know, and it's incredibly valuable to be able to hear other people talk about how they solved some very similar problems to the ones that you have faced or the ones that you face right now. So beyond just meeting other developers and chatting and having a good time, I mean, it's just invaluable to get that knowledge and to see other people struggling with the same things that you are.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about the development strategy you have at Shade Grown? I'm asking this partly because it seems to me that it comes out of that kind of spirit of GDC where you meet people, you talk, and you kind of, it becomes possible to think about developing a game that with your philosophy of development doesn't necessarily mean that you hire 80 people and you go put them in a room and you say, you've got, 6 months to give me something.
Yeah. Yeah. What I wanted to do with Shade Grown is more or less like the opposite of what I had seen in operation at the big places where I used to work. So there isn't really a master schedule and a lot of top-down control. It's a much more organic process. And I think I wanted to try making games this way because, one, I thought that creativity was kind of limited when you go for the top-down approach. And I think that games, you really need a lot of back and forth when you make a game. You really can't dictate a game. I mean, I guess you can, but I think it's very tough to build a game that way. You know, it would be like building a living organism in a top-down way. There would just be a lot of stuff that didn't work or didn't happen the way you planned it to. So I wanted to think more about growing the games in a almost like a biological fashion, if that makes any sense.
Sure. Yeah.
And and GDC is just this froth of ideas and differing opinions and developers sort of discussing their approaches to different problems, developers kind of grandstanding with each other about how cool they are versus other developers and talking about how, you know, we totally solved that problem and we're really awesome and stuff like that. That's all very valuable stuff to hear, see and hear.
Nels, my picture of you at GDC this last time was you were just everywhere and you were always in a hurry to get to the next thing. Like you were going to have a meeting and you had this and that and you couldn't talk about any of it. And I was just so, so curious about, of course, this is all pre-Death Bank. We didn't know much about anything, but yeah. Your version of GDC this last time seemed to be just crazy.
It was pretty frantic. Like Matthew's saying, there's definitely a real danger with anyone to sort of become like for any particular group of people working together to become really creatively inbred, and GDC sort of you could spread your cognitive genetic material around or whatever. So when I go, I usually end up trying to consume as much genetic material as possible. And yeah, I mean, it definitely is the case where it's like so much happens in those 3 or 5 days or whatever it is. It sort of gives you enough things to cognitively chew on for the next year that by the time it's about GDC time, you're like, all right, I have all these things I've been thinking about, but I don't really know how to solve them. Oh, and then I'm going to have 1,000 really smart people to bounce stuff off of.
Yeah. I don't want to put you guys on the spot because, I mean, there's a lot of people we'd be interested in, but if you look at the program on a GDC, all three of you, I presume that you see certain names that are going to make your top list. You're probably going to circle them in your little program before you get there. Who would those people be? I'm talking about presenters. You know, people are going to give talks or they're going to host roundtables or do mm-hmm. sessions or whatever.
Let's see. Randy Smith, I've heard a couple of great talks last year and this year.
He's a Tiger Style now. He did Spider.
He's
game,
a Tiger Style. Right? Yeah, he did Spider, but he's been in the industry for a long time. Robin Hunicke and Kelly Santiago gave a really great talk this year that makes me just very curious about what they have to say.
Yeah. Are you driven by the speaker? I mean, obviously the topic is, it matters, but if you knew that.
With a caveat, as long as they're not speaking on a panel, because I've been to too many really boring panels filled with people who'd be interesting on their own. I don't want to be too inbred just hearing the same people over and over again, of course. But
whenever I'm looking at this stuff, there's sort of like two different threads. There's the stuff that's directly applicable to kind of the space and type of games and stuff that I build. And then there's people who are just always interesting, like Will Wright. I don't think anything I heard him talk about I can directly apply, but he just melts your brain with amazing, oh, look, everything fits together. And then you're like, oh, I see why you are the way you are. So stuff like that. And then on the other side, like Hothead kind of exists in sort of a weird space because we're not like a super tiny indie team of like 3 guys. But we're not like a huge studio with, you know, 200 people and all that stuff, right? So just last year, there was a talk from Donald Mustard of Chair, the guys who did Shadow Complex. And they're one of the few other people who really are about like the same size and space that we are. So I'll usually go looking for that kind of thing, folks who are in sort of our region. And I usually get like the most out of those.
Do you try to have access to these people? I mean, is it possible at GDC for people who've never been there to have access one-on-one to speakers and to sort of, possibly get to meet them afterwards or have dinner or whatever? How possible are those things?
Usually, I mean, you're sort of blown away. Like in my experience, you meet people and the vast majority of the time, they're just totally normal, nice people. Every once in a while, they're kind of crazy. But most folk are just like totally normal, nice people. And it's like after the panel, everybody clears out and they're perfectly happy to talk to you for like 15, 20 minutes about a thing. And then maybe you'll run into them at some party later. And yeah, like everyone is really kind of kind and welcoming. And you know, everyone just sort of has that same motivation about we want to make awesome games and solve interesting problems.
What about you, Matthew?
Gosh, you know, I usually end up going to a very eclectic mix of whatever looks interesting, I guess. And sometimes, you know, sometimes that yields some really interesting stuff, and sometimes it's like stuff that I wish I hadn't gone to. But there's a lot of really good stuff out there about, you know, things that you wouldn't necessarily think apply directly to you. Like one of the things I attended last GDC was a talk about the music of God of War 3 by Clint Bajakian. And he did a great talk. He ended up talking a lot about the dynamic music system and how he and his team authored dynamic music and how they, you know, the system that plays the dynamic music back at you and in response to your actions. So it was a really, you know, it was a great talk that, you know, on the surface has kind of little to do with what I'm working on right now. It's a very completely different style of music. You know, the music is almost in the game for a different purpose. But it's often surprising how relevant almost any of the talks at GDC are to what you do.
I should have gone to that talk because I did a bunch of the procedural music stuff, code side in Deskbank, and it's a lot harder than you'd think.
Yeah, it is. Wow.
So, Yeah, that is definitely like what Matt said is absolutely right. That like things you don't think are going to be necessarily applicable, you just get totally shocked. And you're like, oh, I see. And you put some stuff together and you're like, aha.
I think this is a cross-disciplinary thing too. There's just something kind of magical about being in the presence of someone who's really good at what they do and they can explain it well. And, yeah. and just sort of giving you a chance to sort of peer inside their fat brain for 50 minutes is that there's actually something to be said for that. Mm-hmm. And it may have no practical application at all. That's the thing about GDC that really strikes me. I mean, there are just so many smart people there. And I, of course, from an academic background, you know, I'm used to going to conferences with smart people, but this is a different kind of smart. And I'm not sure if I can figure out how to articulate it, but that it's like these are people oftentimes, and I don't mean to overgeneralize, but that they've been smart their whole lives. Like they grew up probably being a little gifted and, you know, maybe a little bored in school. I've been struck by, for example, how many people I've met at GDC and developers in general who, like, for example, went to Montessori school or had some similar kinds of backgrounds.
That's an interesting observation, actually. Did you just go around asking?
I have done that, yeah. And it very informally. I'm not, like, you know, gathering data or anything or, like, but I think I should at some point be more serious about trying to connect the dots, because I don't think everybody falls into the same pool by any means, but that there are some interesting connections among game designers that you see when you're at GDC, when you're not a designer and I'm not looking for a job. I really am kind of an outsider in ways that it probably makes me a little bit like I'm looking into this fishbowl. And I just have, I find you guys fascinating.
Well, also you mentioned academic conferences. So the thing about the smarts you see at an academic conference versus the smarts you see at GDC, in academic conferences, or at least in math conferences where I've got the most experience, people are really good at relatively well-defined, narrow problems. And where we've got, you know, decades, or in the case of math, millennia of proven successful techniques to approach this sort of thing. At GDC, I mean, nobody really has a clue about how to, you know, do this mixture of making art, making business, having groups of people, you know, potentially large groups of people work together and somehow all make something coherent. There's just so many more diffuse problems than you find in today's specialized academic environment. And there's mysteries everywhere you look. And just listening to people who've been paying attention and thinking about this for a while, they're bound to come up with something that you've never seen before, because there's just so many surprises waiting to be found.
Yeah.
So much that we don't understand.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a tremendous cross-disciplinary kind of, it's at the intersection of so many different disciplines.
Yeah.
I think if I were going to contribute to your anthropological study, Michael, of game developers, I would say one thing I've noticed about game developers is that they're very quick to change topics. Just, again, generalizing as a group, I think there's like a lot of leaping back and forth and jumping from subject to subject and just segueing into something that seems completely random but is actually connected in a certain way.
Yeah. They'll bring up some random book that you would never think of in the context of game development, but then, you know,
apply it into their
conversation and talks about that for 3 minutes, and then it goes somewhere else completely different after that. And
yeah. Or I watched this awesome show about gardens over the weekend.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's just by and large, a community of really sort of agile minds and with maybe somewhat short attention spans and also very youthful. I mean, I think that's the thing I often can't forget is it's still an incredibly young group of people doing big business stuff. And if you attend other big get-togethers that are industry-driven in other fields, you know, I don't know what the average age of each one is, but I would guess that video game industry is pretty young relative to almost all the others.
Mm-hmm. For sure, yeah.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing that happens at GDC, sort of the, one of the downsides of the games industry, is that it tends to be a lot of secrecy. Some of it may be justified, as we were alluding to earlier, with stories spinning out of control, but a lot of it is also not. And at GDC, folks, like, that's sort of when the kimono opens and people are usually willing to talk about just about anything. And that usually doesn't kind of stops for the rest of the year, and then it happens again a year later.
Yeah, these show and tells are fascinating to me, mainly because when you enjoy something, you sort of want to know how it was made or how it was done. I'm a sucker for that stuff. So, yeah. And you can really fill your plate with those kind of talks at GDC. Here's how we did it talks.
Yeah.
So if you had the power to change anything you wanted to about GDC, it is kind of a beast of a conference. Is there anything you'd change about it?
I'd put it in Seattle.
Well, there you go.
Interestingly, like, I think GDC Prime is pretty good. I mean, it's kind of expensive. Like, it'd be great if it was cheaper. But there's also several other GDCs. There's one up here in Vancouver. And I've never been because I've never really felt compelled to go. It's usually only like a couple months after GDC. It's also not cheap. But I wish that I felt compelled to go to that, because obviously, like, relative to the number of people here, like, in the country, Canada has a huge development community, and, you know, sort of feeling cohesiveness and learning from other local folks, both in Vancouver and, you know, Toronto, Montreal, whatever, would be great. But I've never, and most people I talk to never really even regard GDC Canada or want to go. And I wish that wasn't the case. That's also super selfish because it's local and I don't have to travel anywhere.
There's one in Austin too, isn't there?
Yeah.
And there's one abroad somewhere.
Yeah, in Cologne, Germany.
Yeah, right. David, I wanted to ask you, and actually I've been meaning to ask you this for some time. I saw you recently at the Games Learning and Society Conference, which is in Madison, Wisconsin. And of course, I was delighted to see you there, but then I was also kind of curious, like, why would David Carlton go to a Games Learning and Society Conference, which is essentially a conference for teachers and game studies types? I found it wonderful, but interesting that you were there and that there were a few other people there that sort of struck me as kind of like, wonder what he's doing here. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so it was, going there was a lot more, you know, random spur of the moment than going to GDC was. Going to GDC, I originally went because I was pretty sure it would give me a lot of things to think about as a blogger, and then more recently for professional reasons as well. The Games Learning and Society Conference, honestly, I mostly went there for social reasons that, you know, it's always delightful to hang out with you, and it was a chance to meet Roger in person, and I have a close friend who teaches math at the University of Wisconsin, so I could spend time with him. And then also, I was a math professor for 5 years, and I certainly spent more time thinking about teaching than I did thinking about research. And that was a little while ago, but it still leaves me with personal warm feelings about teaching and games. And so I just kind of went as a lark. And I'm sure I'm not going to go every year to that the same way I'm planning to go to GDC. But it was nice to see people at a smaller conference at a university, and go to whatever sessions kind of caught my eye without really worrying too much about what specifically I was gonna get out of them. And you know, I had some pleasant surprises that way, and some pleasant cheese curds were eaten.
Part of the thing about that particular program at Madison, but also just game studies in general, is it has felt to me for some time that there's kind of a disconnect between what they're doing. That it's a very academic exercise, that they do have a keen interest in games and the culture of games and game development, but that at the level at which, you know, someone like Nels or Matthew's working on a game and they're doing what they do, there seems to be a real separation between what the game studies people are interested in and those kinds of specialized conferences.
Yeah, and it was there was a disconnect within the conference too. I mean, that conference had more keynotes than any other conference I've gone to, and they were the most sort of bizarre, incoherent set of keynotes where some people were, you know, reasonably spot on. Some people were kind of strangely ignorant of the how their colleagues were actually using games to teach, which you'd think at Games Learning and Society, this would be not a foreign concept. So it was odd to me how much education there was to do just within the putative topic of the conference.
Yeah, there was this odd moment, and we were both there, and I initially resisted it, but then later I kind of appreciated it. We're all sitting there, and one of the big keynotes is delivered by Rich LeMarchand, who is the co-lead on Uncharted with Amy Hennig. I don't know if you guys have met him, but he's a great guy, a really nice guy, and very generous with his time, and, you know, very willing to talk about process and things. And you guys remember GDC, I mean, those people were all over that conference. They did, you know, 400 different sessions. And I was thinking, what is Rich LeMarchand doing at this conference? Doing a demo of Uncharted 2. I mean, literally, he demoed the game for an audience full of teachers. And I was like, well, you could have sent anybody to do that. And most of the people in the audience, I gathered, really hadn't played it or didn't know much about it. Kind of just the opposite of GDC, where, you know, every little thing about the game people already know. And I guess I came away with that thinking, away from that thinking that we get together and we have these really cool events, but, you know, wow, we still are operating in a little tiny subculture. And you get out of that and all the rock stars and all the really cool people that you meet and all that you're excited about, you just take three steps away from there and back to the real world, and really pretty much a lot of people don't know much about that and don't care.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask Matthew and I wanted to ask Nels sort of a similar question, and it has to do with when you're working on a game and things start to kind of ramp up in terms of getting attention and being in the middle of a growing amount of publicity. And you know, in the case of Hothead, you guys are way more notable as a designer, as a development house than you were, say, a year ago. What's that like? What's it like when you put a game out the door like Death's Bank and a lot of people love it that you've worked on forever?
It's interesting. I mean, like, it is great. It is great, great, great. Putting out a thing and hearing people say they really enjoyed it. You know, they totally appreciated the things you do. Like, I don't know, because I've just sort of been on Death's Bank the whole time. That's the only thing that I've shipped. I don't really have a ton to compare it to. And also because we went from working on one just straight into polishing off another, there wasn't really like a point where everything was just sort of separate. It just kind of kept going. So yeah, I don't really know. It's it's great when people like it, but it doesn't really feel that different to how it did like a year ago or something like that.
Yeah. Did you always know that you were going to have a staggered release date thing? When did you guys decide that?
I don't know.
Okay. That's fair enough. It came as a kind of a wonderful surprise, you know, that if we'd played the game and we were ready to move on, and suddenly there was going to be more Death's Bank.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully lots of people feel that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Matthew, do you remember we were talking about secrets and stuff at GDC? And
Yeah.
So what about you? Shade Grown is an idea. You talk to a few people about it, and then suddenly you start to get a little bit more press and people start to know more about it. And does that make a difference for you? Do you approach what you do any differently, sort of in the public eye?
In the public eye?
Well, you know, to the degree that you are.
I'm not sure that it makes a tremendous difference. I definitely enjoy being able to talk about what I'm doing, and I enjoy being able to be honest about my opinions about things. When you work at a large game company, there's a very strong sense, like we were talking about, of not only keeping secrets, but also like you're not supposed to talk badly about other people's games, because when you do, it gets on a bunch of websites, and causes a big flap where it's like, this guy who worked on Mario says that Gears of War sucks or whatever. Like, it turns into a news item. So the companies try to clamp down on that, and they try to get everyone inside the company to sort of propagate the company message. So I would say that in the last year of going independent, I haven't had to worry about that and can be a little more honest about those kinds of things. And I'm also enjoying talking about development. It's so useful to be able to talk to other people about game development. I'm kind of surprised about how secret developers try to keep things sometimes, because the possibility that the value of your secret is like valuable enough that you would need to prevent anyone else from learning it is pales in comparison to the kind of value you could get if people didn't keep secrets and you could listen to everybody else's story.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So other than that, yeah, I don't know if I feel any sort of like scrutiny or anything like that. In fact, I think more people paid attention to what I was saying when I was like working at a company to make sure that like I wasn't deviating from the message
right.
than they are now.
Well, do you ever miss your anonymity?
I haven't had the occasion to yet, although maybe if I say something really stupid, I will miss it.
Let's get him to say something stupid, guys. What can we get Matthew to say? I mean, it's funny because the fact is you are with Shade Grown Games. You are, we know who you are. I mean, is it as possible for you to go to Magical Wasteland and write, you know, a little diatribe, if that's what's on your mind? Do you sort of have to hesitate?
Maybe in some sense. When I started the blog, like in 2006, I think I was definitely a little more willing to sort of really lay into someone if I thought they were being careless or, you know, talking about something that they didn't really know about. And over the last few years, I've definitely actually kind of made a conscious effort to dial that back. I think not just as a function of not being anonymous anymore, but also as a function of maturing maybe and thinking a little more carefully about the kinds of things that I write online. I still reserve the right to write that kind of stuff now and again, but I don't want to do it as much as I used to.
The problem for you is that when you write in that style, you're very entertaining. So, you know, it's actually, I kind of like miss that little voice. You know, you would sometimes, you know, take people to task for their writing, for example, which is, you know, that's, we need to do that sometimes. People need to be held accountable occasionally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why do you continue to write about games on your blog? And I'd ask the same thing of the other two of you. You guys are busy guys. You got a lot of stuff to do. You're trying to make games. Why do you take the time to write about them on the side?
For me, the reason I do it is you don't really know what you really think until you try to write it down, because mm-hmm. you'll have these thoughts and you think they're great, they're brilliant thoughts, and you will have some sort of idea, but when you write it down, then you look at it and you go, actually, that's really just a half-formed idea. That's not really a good thought. So for me, the process of writing is very much entwined in the process of thinking about games. And if I'm going to think about games, I might as well write about games, because actually writing about games kind of keeps you honest, especially on a blog where people can leave comments and be like, you know, you kind of left this out. You left out this detail, or you didn't really give this its due, and things like that. That's really valuable for me. And so I think of the process of writing about games as the process of thinking about games. And that's, I think, the most important reason why I continue to do it. It's also fun. Writing is fun, and I enjoy it.
Yeah. I'll echo that. I mean, I like thinking about stuff and I like playing games, and I would have a real cognitive dissonance if I weren't writing about games. I would start to wonder if games are a waste of time or something. And I mean, they're not, but part of the way I prove that to myself is by writing about them. But I also find that whenever I'm playing games, I'm thinking about things, and thoughts kind of get stuck in my head until they've come out onto my blog. And so I kind of get mentally blocked. until I've written about it. And then, so I'll, you know, I'll be walking to and from work and just thinking about the same thing over and over again. And then I can finally, then I finally find, you know, an evening to write it down. And then there's that problem's, you know, out of my head, and then I can think about something else.
Yeah. And for me, at least, I mean, maybe this wouldn't be as much of a big deal if I was, you know, a pure designer that just wrote a lot of design docs and not much else. But given that the problems I'm solving day in, day out are more of a blend, like being able to step away from more technical, how do I actually make a thing work type of problem solving, and just very briefly think, regard different sorts of problems, ideas, whatever, is helpful, I think. And I was going to say it before Matthew beat me to the punch, that it absolutely does keep you honest.
It's good that I'm recording this, because, you know, this is what we teach students. This notion of writing is thinking. You think through writing, right? That you, and it's a way of being honest and hard on yourself and discovering what you really think. So yeah, this is being recorded, and I will play it back to my students. I'll be forced to listen to all of you. Matthew will become the enforcer for the things I'm trying to say here. Not only do I do this.
I hope they never find out how I actually did in school.
Oh, that's the other thing. Yeah, you know, the commonalities. That's another thing, another little thread, a little anthropology experiment. A lot of these guys, and they are mostly guys, didn't do so well in school. Or they could have done better, but they were bored or whatever. Their grades probably weren't a reflection of
unrealized potential kind of kid.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we're just about out of time. And before we go, I just thought we'd toss it around the horn, see if there's a game that you've been playing recently that you might like to recommend to listeners, something big or small.
I just had a good time with the Minerva's Den single player expansion for BioShock 2.
Yeah.
If you like BioShock and or BioShock 2, this is a great little sort of self-contained story in the BioShock universe, and I liked it quite a bit. So,
yeah, do you feel like it's kind of goodbye to Rapture?
Yeah, the story doesn't explicitly tie up Rapture itself, but it's a nice little sort of self-contained epilogue kind of.
Yeah, epilogue is a good word. Yeah. Okay, so Minerva's Den.
I'll make a plug for two things. One is, and you've blogged about this yourself, it's not a game but a device. The iPad, I think, is a much, much more compelling gaming platform than I expected. I had big hopes for the iPhone when I got one, and I just never played games on it. But I think the iPad is a really wonderful game device, and there's different genres that work well in it compared to consoles and PCs. And so that's been a real eye opener for me. The other surprise in terms of games that I've played recently is I was really surprised how well Killer 7 held up. We played that in the Vintage Game Club a few months ago, and I remember when I first played it being not sure what to think about it, but then it stayed it kept on staying in my head. I'd have little flashbacks from scenes to it, and playing it again. It's funny because at the time it made strange, you know, decisions for the graphics and for the gameplay that seemed a little bit, you know, passé. But in retrospect, looking back, the odd gameplay and the odd graphics have held up so much better than games that were trying to push the forefront in those areas. And so it's a world completely like anything, completely unlike anything else that I've ever played. And I wish more people would play it so that they could explain to me what on earth is going on in there, because I think that there's no end of material to be mined from it, and I want to understand more.
Yeah, if you're interested game, if you were befuddled by it or whatever, it's probably worth a trip over to the VGC just to check out the conversation people had about it, because I thought people posted some really cool stuff, some, you know, some insights and some personal reactions to it that could be helpful if you find it inaccessible for whatever reason.
Great. So I'm going to very quickly plug a thing I just finished and a thing I'm super excited to start. So I recently finished Shank from Clay Entertainment, local folks here in Vancouver. It's great. It is gorgeous, and I don't usually like combo-y beat-em-ups, but I really, really liked Shank. So that was great. And then Frictional's new game, they made the Penumbra series of games. Their new game, Amnesia, just came out today, actually. And I love me some horror games, so I'm really stoked to wait till it gets a little bit darker and then start playing that and be very afraid.
What format is that on?
That's on Steam. Okay. PC, Mac. I think they might even have a Linux build.
What's different about it that makes you sort of change your mind about the genre?
So I was actually talking to Jamie, the CEO of Clay, about this, and I couldn't really put my finger on it. I mean, I don't like Devil May Cry. I don't like Bayonetta. I don't know if it's just that because it's a 2D thing that kind of the move set was compressed enough that I never really felt frustrated by it. Or maybe just that it's short enough, right? Like 3 hours end to end, you can be done. That's totally sufficient. Yeah, I don't know. But it's on XBLA and PSN, so folks should at least check out the demo. Because even if you don't normally like a type of game, maybe you'll be like me and really like it.
The complaint that a game is too short, I've noticed in the last couple of years, has become the virtue of the game, is people talking about games.
Definitely.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I hope
people
will pop over to your haunts and check out what you guys are up to after they listen to this podcast. Maybe we can get together at GDC. You guys all going to go? Planning on going?
Absolutely.
All right.
You can all come to my place, and we can all play Rock Band together if you want.
Sounds good.
Rock Band 3?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Keyboards and all.
Okey-dokey.
Awesome. Well,
gents, have a good night, and thank you very much for your time. And hopefully we'll chat again soon, and happy gaming.
Awesome. You too.
Thanks. Thank you, Michael.